And you are listening to Recovery Radio on KRFP. I'm Radio Johnny, and she is Denise. Hello, Denise.
Hello, everyone. Hello, Johnny. I'm glad to be here and grateful to be in recovery. And
with us today in the studio is Casey. Casey is a counseling intern who is working here at the Recovery Center, working with peers and people that come in seeking counseling services. And good afternoon, Casey. How are you?
Hi, I'm doing well. And thank you, Radio Johnny is your name.
That really caught on, didn't it? Yeah, I don't. It's just Denise. I don't have any. Okay.
You don't want to start one right now?
Well, we call it a star.
Star.
I told Johnny a secret from a kind of like a thing that when I was in like kindergarten or first grade that I had a couple of names I came up with, and one of them was Star. So he started calling me Star. But the Radio Johnny thing, I mean, everybody calls you that.
That came from the Recovery Center. Nice. Somebody went, oh, you're Radio Johnny.
Yes.
That was it.
Well, we're so glad you're here, Casey. That's awesome.
Yeah, thank you. I'm so glad to be here. Thanks for asking me to speak with you today.
Yeah.
Why don't we kick off with a little bit of your history, your background, so to speak.
Yeah, sure. So I got my undergrad at the University of Idaho in early childhood development, and so now I'm finishing my master's to be a licensed mental health therapist, and it's actually through the Divine Mercy University, and so that's located in DC. They have the brick and mortar building there, but I grew up here in Moscow, and so moving to DC just would have been like a culture shock. And we visit there for residency a few times every year, and it's like wonderful to visit, but definitely not a place where I'd love to like live all year round.
So
I've been doing it over distance.
So you're kind of sort of on like, it's like an online that you're being able to do it.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, which during like COVID, that was not a problem. It's like, oh, school
so
continues
already,
as normal.
You were already set up for it. Well,
yes.
That's awesome.
Yeah, exactly. And just what I really love about my education through Divine Mercy University is it's been looking at counseling the individual holistically. And I think that's a pretty key part of just recovery, and what we're coming to find out in research and more treatment modalities is just all about like how we've been looking at the person just through one lens, you know, whatever that lens is, and how we know like we're more than just one thing, and so just inviting us to begin to ask what those other lenses are, like to look at the whole person. Because the more we do that, the more success we'll see in a person's recovery.
So. Oh, wow. That's fascinating. When you say look through more than one lens, what type of things are you looking at? From my lack of understanding of what modalities necessarily are in that.
Yeah. So when... Oh man, so this is such a big topic that like I could go all over.
Sure,
so
sure. Go ahead.
Just go wherever you
want. Yeah.
We have a really bright listenership, so they'll probably enjoy it.
Yeah. So just I mean, when we look at, you know, the question of recovery alone, you know, it just knowing that we don't treat a person like we don't try and help them only through like physical means or only to look at them as, well, they just need more people in their lives, or, you know, but the fact that we are people who have like physical needs, you know, they're very real, like physical realities to us. We have emotional needs, we have social needs, we have spiritual needs. We have all these different kind of needs, and Maslow's hierarchy, you know, kind of points us in that direction. And maybe later on the show, I'd love to talk more about this recent research I've been doing, chronic pain, and how the solution to that, you know, here we use typically like medication, and of course we have the opioid crisis, and through like, through actual research, there are so many non-pharmacological solutions to chronic pain that really help a person tap into things beyond just the physical. And so
that would be great to get into, because you happen to be sitting with two people who suffer from chronic back pain.
Yeah,
so
it's a common thing.
That would be a really
helpful
for us. To heck with the audience at this point.
Yeah. It's all about us, I'm sorry. No, I'm just kidding.
Selfishness and self-centeredness.
We will all benefit from it. No, it's all good.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is an older statistic, but in my research it was 1 in 3 people in the U.S. have chronic pain.
Well,
1 in 5 in other parts of the world have chronic pain. And so, yeah, it's very likely that people listening have chronic pain, whether it's, you know, very small or large. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's a real issue.
Cool. And we'll get into that maybe after the break. That'll be good. Now, when you're talking about kind of stepping back here a foot, mm-hmm. I know from my involvement with people in AA and involvement with people in the center that people with all sorts of addictions, that's kind of my go-to, mm-hmm. is that there always seems to be other underlying issues. Mm-hmm. A lot of like opioid abusers started out with, you know, chronic back pain or an injury of some sort. Mm-hmm. And you know, whether you want to call it addictive personality or mm-hmm. Exactly what, I mean, it doesn't always, it probably more often than not starts out as not as a let's do some hydros and party, you know.
That's,
it's like
that
I'm
is
taking,
correct.
I'm taking these for pain, and you know, as before you get the mental addiction, you start developing your body gets used to the drug.
Yeah, and physiologically.
Yeah, and it doesn't work as well. So mm-hmm. sometimes your
the
dosage
tolerance.
Will tolerance, right?
Right.
You develop a tolerance,
and your brain does all sorts of things with rewiring,
right?
And synapse, mm-hmm. and all sorts
right,
of
and
stuff.
that can happen
yep.
along the way too.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. But then, in addition to, you know, that actual either physical dependence—that's mm-hmm. the word I was looking for. The dependence, and then maybe becomes addiction, and people that usually transition from dependence to addiction usually have other issues, mental issues going along
right.
with that. Depression, mm-hmm. PTSD, and you know, a laundry list of other things that, you know, abuse,
right.
The drugs or the alcohol relieves the pain
right.
short
it
term,
a coping.
But you know, it becomes the greater, well, maybe not even greater issue, but you know, like a co-issue.
Exactly.
Right.
Yep. And so that's like a pretty common phrase in my studies is the co-occurring.
Right.
And I mean, really, you know, it's just with addiction, we should be asking ourselves like, how did this person get here, get to this point? You know, very often there are other things. You know, we go to the doctors, we find out we have a certain illness, and for a lot of those illnesses, there can be direct causes. You know, a lot of what we are suffering can be connected back to lifestyle practices. And I mean, man, like individuals, like we've all, an individual at any age has lived through so much. And so that's why it's just imperative, like especially my own philosophy is, you know, when I meet with someone, I really want to get to know that person. And that's going to take a long time. And that's going to take just a lot of vulnerability because, I can't seek to help someone just, you know, by saying, oh, well, here, I'll give you this medication or I'll give you this quick therapy. You know, there's all of this history that's gone into this individual's life. And just kind of going back to what you were talking about, though, that that question of what led this person here. And there's so much that research shows that we're kind of catching up to now, like with that understanding. And my favorite research on that topic is the adverse childhood experiences.
That's just what I was thinking of.
Right.
Yeah, there's I think I've read on it. Have you read on that one?
I have not read on it. I've been read into it. My sister has spent a lot of years in therapy,
mm-hmm.
Relating back to, you know, her childhood. But I have three older sisters, and two of them were out of the house and gone by the time I was like, I don't know, 7 or 8 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So, but the next eldest sister and I, you know, grew up in the dysfunctional alcoholic household together.
Mm-hmm.
She sought therapy. I sought alcohol and drugs and mm-hmm. and sex and mm-hmm. you know, you name it.
Yeah, I'm anything thinking, to numb that.
Right, exactly, to get around it.
I'm thinking that Daryl and the recovery center is also familiar with that because of a class that I took here, and they asked questions,
hmm.
and we would step forward if it applied, we would step back if it didn't, and then when I read about the information later in an article, it sounded really familiar, so I think the LRC is
right,
very familiar
that's,
with that.
Right, that's part of the
that's
part
good.
Of the,
yeah. I've never had that conversation with them. That is awesome, though, because after I learned about it, which was just a few years ago, it's something I've asked many people about, and a good majority of people don't know about it, which I think, like, awareness is key with this topic of ACEs, that the more you know, that in itself, like, can be very healing, because it gives that answer that people have been looking for, like, why am I like this? Why do I choose this? And why...
Can you give me three examples of the ACEs questions to three come to mind?
Yeah,
ACEs.
So,
wait a minute, definition please.
Yeah, so let me go back a little bit. So ACEs, actually very interestingly enough, like, was created by accident. So it started by Dr. Filiti and Vincent Filiti, and this, he actually, his focus was how to help obese patients lose weight. And so he created this program that really did just that. And so, like, over these months, people started losing weight, and then something interesting happened. You know, you imagine, like, a program that's actually helping, people are actually, they're going to continue in it, right? You
right.
know, you're meeting your goal, like, you're going to continue with that. But he found the opposite happened, that as these people were losing weight, they started dropping out. And so he followed up with them, and he came to find out by asking just different kind of questions into that, that a lot of people just said, it just made me more anxious. My coping mechanisms, like, of eating were taken away. I felt more vulnerable because I just felt like men looking at me, you know, like, it would, like, they could use me now that I was becoming slimmer. And then probing further into that, finding out, like, these individuals were sexually abused. And so he came to understand that people weren't obese because of just, like, genetic factors, or, you know, they couldn't figure out how to not be so. They could, but it was the fact that there were these underlying issues, emotional issues, mental health issues, that was actually driving them to this. And so what he then did is he got permission by the CDC to do the adverse childhood experience survey, and to where he got a lot of the same people and more people, and he asked them 10 simple questions. And these questions were basically all about asking a person between the ages of birth and 18 if they had ever experienced physical, sexual, emotional abuse or neglect, which, fun fact, did you know that a child experiencing emotional neglect can oftentimes produce even worse consequences than sexual abuse or physical abuse? So that's an interesting thing that I think a lot of people, you know, don't realize. So the point being that all of these kinds of abuse or neglect are all can be very harmful to a person if left untreated. So those, and then as well as just a child living in a home with alcoholic or drug using parents, parents who were in prison, parents with mental health conditions, whether diagnosed or not, it's still the same. It's the same experience for a child. So a lot of these things, and in fact, you know, the survey was created in the 80s, and so if this were created again now, like updated, we'd probably include things like bullying and death definitely, because that's a huge thing in recovery, right? Like in addiction, I mean. And so he found, though, I would just encourage you all to go look this up to learn more about it, and a good book on it. It's by Dr. Nakazawa, because you can yourself take this survey, and then it also would lead you deeper into that journey to kind of find out what's maybe underlying some of these issues.
Well, what's interesting is I think my brother knew about this. He was back on the East Coast, but I saw it, I think it was before Christmas, so it would be last winter of like 2019, on Facebook. It was just, and somebody had shared it. It was on Facebook. I went in and took the quiz and stuff like that. And then I started to realize, I think that I had kind of taken a little bit of a quiz over here. And, but that was the one thing that I think I saw that wasn't on there was, had a family member died or mm-hmm. been murdered or, right. you know, like, I think there was something about violence. And I think that really counts as far as post-traumatic stuff.
Yes.
You know,
yeah.
like, so. But I thought it was very interesting, and I was thinking maybe, did it talk about homelessness or...
It didn't, but that would be, like,
another one
thing.
Maybe,
yeah.
you know, because... Yeah, but I just thought it was super interesting
mm-hmm.
to understand that, you know. And I think they're going into prisons and talking to people, too. I saw an article about that, and trying to help people understand, you know, hey... there's these underlying things
yeah.
and then look where you are now,
mm-hmm.
you know, because it was never really addressed. And if someone's, you know, father was beating them
mm-hmm.
and telling them that they were worthless, you know, the chances of them, you know, going out to the world and being productive are a little slimmer. So.
Right.
It's
yeah,
just,
exactly. It's like what we experience growing up, like it has consequences.
Right. And like what was modeled to us?
Mm-hmm.
What did we see our parents and the adults around us? How did they handle things?
Mm-hmm.
Like, how did they handle everything?
Well,
yeah.
here's an anecdotal example from my childhood.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with two alcoholic parents, things are always chaotic. Everything happened at a very high volume.
Mm-hmm.
Every discussion, whatever.
A little bit of yelling?
You know, a lot of yelling.
Yeah.
And all their friends they hung out with were basically alcoholic as well.
Mm-hmm.
So conditions were same there. When I was, you know, going to school and I would meet a friend, I would go, you know, over to their house after school or something to hang out and watch TV or something. And their parents were, you know, quiet, spoke politely, were nice to the children. And I thought that was very weird. I felt very uncomfortable in those environments.
Because you weren't familiar with it.
Yeah. It's like, wow, your parents are really strange. And they're looking at me going like, dude, I've been to your house.
See, and that's like a whole topic in and of itself, like for relationships.
Right.
That's why I really recommend people who are in recovery, and anyone really, just like to slow down when it comes to relationships. Especially, you know, if you come from a background that was not modeled like with healthy relationships, because
mm-hmm.
it's true, you know, you like are pickers, you know, they say like is going to be off, you know, it's because we go after relationships that are familiar to us.
Right.
And
right.
So, yeah, there's things like with codependency and that. And,
right.
But essentially, like that just kind of goes into one of my other favorite theories is attachment theory, and just like you were talking about, Denise, just what you grow up with, you know, you're a new child, and we refer to ourselves as children as scientists, where we're exploring and learning about like what is this world, you know, who am I and how am I in relationship with others. And so exactly like how that's modeled to you as a child, that's how you then learn to view yourself,
yeah.
other people, how you think that they view you, you know, and that's huge.
And that is huge, how you think other people think about you.
Because
mm-hmm. guess what? We don't actually know necessarily. Like,
mm-hmm.
that's
mm-hmm.
that's why
we just try not to worry
anymore.
We just want
to
be loved. I mean,
mm-hmm.
that's my thing, you know. Mm-hmm. I have to be wanted and needed and loved. I mean, that was a big part, you know, of my addiction. You know, I wanted something I couldn't have, you know. Mm-hmm. I thought it was a God-given right. Mm-hmm. Turns out, you know, you got to give a little bit away to get a little bit back. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't doing that because I was looking out for myself. If that didn't work, I would go to the look at me, look at me, look at me, look at me, you know, which is the driving force behind all great actors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I would say that I think that a lot of, you know, when there's, at least for myself, growing up, kind of just basically being more selfish about my, you know, it was about me, you know.
Right.
So when you have a relationship with someone and it's all about you, yeah, and what you want, and it's the kind of manipulation that isn't like, well, okay, manipulation is just bad, just all around. Mm-hmm. You know, didn't at the time to me, it didn't seem like it was this vicious kind of manipulation, but it was making it to where things were smooth for me. Like,
right,
you know what I mean? Where you, yeah, manipulate in those ways where you're like, let's keep things nice and calm and happy, you know, but then you're not actually talking about what the real issues are.
Right.
You can't have a real conversation because that would shake the boat.
Yeah.
So you just do the things to make the person happy or yourself happy. And I tell you what, that eventually doesn't work out well. You can only juggle that for so long, and then you have to start having real conversations,
mm-hmm,
where things start falling apart. And then how do you have those real conversations if they weren't ever modeled to,
exactly,
you?
Yeah.
Know, how do you do that?
Yep.
So that's the deal. Like, I feel like in recovery, I got through the addiction part of things, and now it's like, how do we do healthy life,
mm-hmm,
and relationships with others, along with like trying to make amends?
Mm-hmm.
What does that look like? And,
mm-hmm,
just live each day, and it not being about me, just me. Like, looking at how I'm living and the choices that I'm making, and not judging other people. But it's not the selfish thing, you know what I mean? It's the,
right,
how am I doing with other people instead of how are they doing and what are they doing for me, you know?
Yeah, yeah, that's why I'd recommend, I remember the book now, Disrupted Childhood.
Oh.
And,
nice,
you know, kind of the first half of the book goes into ACEs, what those are, that it actually has the questions there and all of that. And the second half, though, is kind of looking more into, yeah, how do I kind of change? You know, these are the things I struggle with, and it's really built deeply within me. It's like you said, it was modeled to me. It was my familiar, you know.
Right.
And so the second half of the book goes into actual things that you can do, different kind of help, very different things that help to rewire our brain. Because that's the good news. The good news that this is like one of the most exciting times to be a therapist, you know, is just we know that our brain can be rewired. So it's great hope, you know.
Right.
So all we have to do is courageously kind of confront like what is in our past and what and how that has affected where we are today, and seek out the kind of support that can help us to begin that journey, because like there's good news if we do that.
Right. It's good to know that modern science is finally catching up with AA.
Yeah.
You know, in their fourth step, where we,
right,
you know, make a list of all persons we have harmed,
mm-hmm,
you know, including ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we list out what we call character defects that led us to those things, and those are the things we work on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, obviously, you know, quite different and a little more, probably a little more, what you're talking about is a little easier, a little softer way, which is better than just, you know, basically confronting things on your own with maybe just your AA sponsor. But it's a very similar concept. I would say almost identical.
Well, and we have to be honest.
Right.
Like, we have to be honest with ourselves. And
right.
One of someone that I really respect, who's a great psychologist, Dr. Jordan Peterson, that's one of his core things. Like, it sounds like AA, you know,
mm-hmm,
too, is just like, I mean, how can we move anywhere if we're not honest with ourselves? You know, if we're,
right,
if,
exactly,
we're running a race, like, we have to know where we're standing then in order to move forward.
Right.
You know.
Sure.
And I'm
sure,
you know, AA or NA or any kind of those kinds of programs,
would probably agree that, you know, getting outside counseling or
other kinds
of things is great. I mean, I think in recovery that it's, that at least for myself, it's been really good as the 6 years has moved on. There's been like these things that I've done in different areas that I've had to work on, and different people that have helped me with those things, and just keep kind of moving forward with it.
Mm-hmm.
And it, you know, you just keep praying and hoping that the right people and the right circumstances come in so that you can work through things and get support. But I think understanding about your childhood and being able to identify those things and work on getting some healing, and then realizing, for at least for myself, I realized, you know, I don't want these things from back here to continue to affect me today, every day.
Right.
You know, and how do I work through that?
Right.
Yeah, that's key. Because it's like, on one hand, I mean, I really want people, like, hearing this just to know, I mean, whatever happened to you, like, that's not your fault. And, I mean, that's such a simple phrase, but, like, I mean, really, I mean, how often do we think of that? And because that can, we can be so afraid to kind of see how we really are in certain situations, you know, because it's our weakness, it's our character defects.
Right.
But it's all that we've learned. And so, like, I just really hope that people will, like, come to just be open to, you know, reviewing that, just to know, like, this is what I've learned, that's not my fault. But then, as you said, like, it is our choice, it's our responsibility. What do we want to do with that now? You know, like you said, I don't
find healing,
want to stay here.
Yeah,
like, that is your choice, and that's great. It, you know, we could be stuck here the rest of our lives, but we can choose not to be.
So can you tell us what you do here at the Recovery Center?
Yeah, so I'm working on the crisis side, but I love going to spend time at the on the recovery side.
Yes.
Just, I think it's a population that gets overlooked, and like I said, just learning, like, a lot of this research that people don't know about. You know, some people know about it, some people don't, and it's like, okay, well, I want to tell anyone who doesn't know. And I can actually give the survey, just 10 simple questions. By giving that to clients who come to meet with me, we know, and again, you can look this up, but it shows, like, your score, you know, however, you get a point for every question you answer. Yes, that did happen to me. The higher your score, the more likely you are to experience physical health issues, mental health issues, addiction, just to name a few things. And so I just kind of like to normalize that for them. You know, like, we go through those experiences, and then I show them, wow, so this is your score. That must have been really hard growing up. And, you know, we talk about that, and then kind of connecting, like, well, it's no wonder, like, you chose, you know, this is your coping style. Like, this is really normal. And these things are happening to you. You're experiencing these things. This is normal for what you experienced. And so kind of just going through that. But then those who come to see me, it's, you know, it's because they don't want to remain there. And so it's like, okay, well, then I find out, well, have you been in therapy? What have you tried before? What didn't work? What did work? And then we go from there. And there's a few things I'm learning right now, like treatment modalities that I think will be really helpful, and research shows are helpful to, like, those target populations, and that's EMDR. And then, as I want to talk to you later about, MBSR, which helps with chronic pain.
Acronyms.
Yes. So EMDR is eye movement desensitization reprocessing. And it's one of, like, the better known therapies that help the most with PTSD. And PTSD is a really common thing in this.
Would you say that brings calming, like, that helps with anxiety?
Yeah, so that can help with anxiety. Level one is, like, really just anxiety kind of disorders. Level two are those more, like, just more severe, like, PTSD symptoms. But yeah, anxiety is definitely, like, an aspect of PTSD, right? And that's the cool thing, is just, like, just what research is showing us, like if you've experienced these ACEs, your brain changes. Okay, so yeah, so your amygdala is bigger.
Because you need to survive through these things. I mean, those 10 things are pretty rough. Even if you score a couple of them.
Right, yep.
One or two of those can pretty much, you know, cause issues.
One or two can cause greater increase in depression, you know, that alone, just with divorce, you know. So that's why it's important for people to know, like, what these risk factors are, just to maybe help explain why they're feeling a certain way. And
so you're teaching them, Casey, how to do this. You're working with them and teaching them how to do it so that then they can have that tool for themselves?
Yeah. So I guess going off of with that is there are lots of, like, strategies that we can kind of relearn and use at home. So, for instance, like I was saying, how our amygdala is bigger and our hippocampus is a lot smaller, and our prefrontal cortex, like, isn't really going on. It's offline a lot.
Yeah.
So it's more about just, like, fight or flight all the time, which is one reason why we have more physical health issues.
So in that, what you just described,
yeah,
that lowers your ability to make decisions.
Right, yep.
So that's a really big deal, your ability to make clear, thought-out decisions, because that's the front part?
Yep, prefrontal cortex. Yeah,
prefrontal cortex.
Yeah.
So as you're working on doing these things and getting things more balanced out, are you seeing that it's helping people, or is research showing
that
it's helping people get that area? What is it called again?
Yeah, the prefrontal cortex.
Prefrontal cortex working better so they can make better decisions.
Exactly. Yeah, it's
like, that's a really big deal. I read
isn't
something
that?
About that, and I was just like, "Are you kidding me?
Right?
Oh my goodness! Of course." I had a hard time making sound decisions back then. Oh,
yeah.
My goodness.
And doesn't that kind of normalize it? Like, makes you kind of feel like, wow, okay, gee, that wasn't my fault. I mean, I do want to take responsibility
for it.
And now I know about this, like, you know, okay, I can do things now that will help that. Like, yeah.
Because I related it to when I was, I was an addict, opiates and meth.
Mm-hmm.
And during those years, I mean, it was crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I came into recovery 6 years ago and I started seeing other people come in that I knew, and I just started seeing so much change in myself and others, I was like, it was those drugs. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was a total jerk then. And slowly things have gotten better.
Mm-hmm.
So as people come in and they had stopped doing that kind of stuff, I was like, wow, I see so much changes, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's like their brain's healing and there's all these changes.
Yeah, and just being
right, because why would I, as an alcoholic, think another drink would be what I need to make something better?
Right.
You know, even when...
Our choices
the odd thing about alcoholics is, you know, people think, well, yeah, you know, if you had a crappy week, you know, putting on a good bender on the weekend, that's normal. Yeah, but an alcoholic will have a really good week and think putting a bender on the weekend that lasts till the following Wednesday is a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's that bizarre decision-making
is broken.
Right.
And that's even, you know, I did stuff like that even before, you know, I was a chronic daily drinker.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I made bad decisions like that all the time. Go get drunk at the bar and drive.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's supposedly a no-brainer,
anymore.
Call an Uber, call a cab.
Wasn't that sort of modeled for you growing up?
Well, to a certain extent, yeah. I mean, I can remember family road trips where, you know, parents are drinking beer in the front of the car as we're hurtling down the highway with no seatbelts on, you know.
Yeah.
Anyways, I'm so sorry to interrupt what you were talking about, but I just,
Yeah, no, so it's just like, I mean, okay, because just off of what you're kind of talking about, though, like, you typically grow up then, if you grow up in a family that resolves conflicts in a healthy manner, then you'll see very, like, simple things, like the fact that, oh, I can breathe normally during this conflict because it doesn't heighten my fight or flight mode, right?
You don't have to be scared.
Yeah, so, but then it's like people who have grown up in those more hostile environments that fight or flight mode is on...
hypervigilance.
Right, hypervigilantly, yeah. And so then you're not breathing, you're catching your breath. You know, and so it's like even at the very like simple fact of teaching breathing exercises, it's like, well, why does that work? Well, because we should always be breathing like this. So it's kind of relearning these things that for a very long time you haven't been doing, right? And so it's even simple things like that. And then to, it's kind of funny. It's just, I don't know. Like, I've gotten into this because it's like, man, I don't, you know, I want people to get their lives back, right? You know, with trauma, it's like their life was going in a certain way, and then experiencing these effects, like these experiences early on that were traumatic, like changed your course. But like now, you can have an even greater life than what you would have had, you know, if you want to keep, if you want to continue on to the road of recovery, like it can look even better than what it would have looked like. But yeah, I just want people to get their lives back. And
do you think, I don't know what comes to mind is like, because you had those experiences and then you got back on track,
mm-hmm.
you can relate with other people and their hard times as well, you know? So
yeah, it would definitely
valuable, I think.
Yeah, well, you definitely would develop more empathy, I would think. That would probably be a given.
Mm-hmm.
Because you would be able to learn empathy. Mm-hmm. I would imagine that would be part of the course of treatment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's easy enough to, you know, if somebody is addicted and you do the research and you find out, well, yeah, they were emotionally, physically abused as children. You know, you address the addiction with, you know, basically stopping or, you know, some sort of physical intervention therapy, you know, whether it's Suboxone for opioid users or, you know, just a detox for an alcoholic. And once you get that symptom taken care of, you dive right into the background,
mm-hmm.
the depth of the problem, so to speak. And once you start, I found for myself, once I started dealing with those underlying issues, empathy just kind of started welling up. I mean, I thought I had empathy, but, you know, it wasn't... It was more of just a recognition of a state.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't really feeling it.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been able to develop my empathy so that when, you know, someone comes in new to an AA group,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they say, I just don't know what to do. I can look at them and honestly say, I know exactly how you feel.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this is what I did. So let's maybe try some of these things and see how it works for you. So, but empathy, yeah, is a real important thing. It allows us to make sacrifices we wouldn't normally try,
mm-hmm.
you know. And with somebody who's constantly in a fight or flight mode, you certainly don't want to waste a lot of time on other people.
Right,
yeah.
When you need that time to protect yourself.
Yeah.
Constantly.
Right.
So, hey, let's take a little break for a minute, and I want to come back. I really want to hit the chronic pain and your research on that, because that sounds fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, let's pause it for a second.
And you are listening to KRFP, Moscow Pullman's Recovery Radio.
Her Majesty's a pretty nice girl, but she doesn't have a lot to say. Her Majesty's a pretty nice girl, but she changes from day to day. I wanna tell her that I love her a lot, but I gotta get a belly full of wine. Her Majesty's a pretty nice girl, someday I'm gonna make her mine, oh yeah, someday I'm gonna make her mine.
And we are back. We're talking with Casey here at the Latah Recovery Center. The Rural Crisis Center Network is where she spends most of her time, but as she was telling us, she does do some work with the peers on the other side of the wall, so to speak. And Denise, you came up with some interesting thoughts on the break about chronic pain and your particular situation.
Well, I've noticed, first of all, Casey had brought up in the beginning of the show that she had some information or interest in the chronic pain area.
And so I've just noticed that it seems like people have chronic pain issues due to food, like their diet. Sometimes they change their diet around, and that seems to help. To their environment, to injuries, different kinds of injuries that we've gone through. Also to repetitive things. I have some issues with my foot due to always working on my feet and not being at a desk job. So I think that there's a lot of different things that lead to chronic pain, whether it would be something passed down in your gene pool, you know, it could be something genetic, or
my arthritis.
Yep, yeah, arthritis. Yeah. And so there's just a lot of different things that we deal with that cause chronic pain. And I don't know about you guys, but I like to find some answers. And I've found some answers in some ways that were very destructive to me in my opioid addiction. So now I'm going a different route to try to help myself. And so we are super interested on what you have to say about this subject, Casey. So
yeah, thank you. Yeah, definitely. And I think that is a great start with the fact that we do know, like, there are many factors to chronic pain, whether it is genetic, even within addictions too. We know, like I was just reading yesterday, that women are more susceptible, like when drinking alcohol, like over long term, like osteoporosis can be a factor with that. And so, you know, it can come from our different lifestyle practices, foods, you know, a lot of different things. And so I guess I'm here to talk on one aspect that might help people, that if a lot of that chronic pain is a result of kind of trauma, then this, you know, would maybe be a good thing to try. And so this therapy, I'm newly learning about it, so I'm not an expert at all about it, but it's called MBSR, or mindfulness-based stress reduction. I would check out Palouse Mindfulness. I'm not sure if it's .com or .org, but Palouse Mindfulness, or Google MBSR free online. Typically, you know, in person or online, it can be, there's a price tag to it. This website is put out by someone who's certified in it, but retired and wants to just give back to the community.
Nice.
And so it is an excellent source for people. It's very valid. So again, that's mindfulness, or Palouse Mindfulness.
And so you were saying that this could be helpful for someone who has experienced physical or emotional trauma to their body?
Right. So I might
What all would that, is that all it would encompass?
So, and I'll even say that this could be helpful for anyone. We don't know the limits. So now if you want to try this out, your pain may not go completely away, but because there are studies on that where pain has reduced but not gone away. There are other studies, just depending on the population, what people have experienced, where pain has completely gone away. And so I would just say, if you want to try this, go into it with an open mind and see how it affects you. It is an evidence-based practice, so there is a ton of research on it. I wouldn't suggest it if it wasn't. It has been shown not only to help with chronic pain, but also depression, anxiety, and different mental health symptoms. And so there's just a lot of research that goes into it that reveals that. So in giving a little bit of background about it, one reason I brought up of, like, if you kind of grew up with a tense childhood, mindfulness, MBSR kind of focuses on the fact that the emotions that we have going around in our mind is strongly connected to our body. So MBSR reminds us of that mind-body connection. And we know this in science, that emotions, like the thoughts and the feelings that are occurring within our mind, our brain, release actual chemicals, right? Hormones into our body. The more stressed out we are, negative emotions releases cortisol. And so this is something that Bessel van der Kolk, a very famous psychiatrist who wrote The Body Keeps the Score, another good book, he kind of talks about this as, man, if you grew up with this in your childhood, just like of this chronic stress, this hypervigilance, your body, just look at it, like, over time, you know, arching shoulders, like, tense, like a you know,
Johnny just sat up straight, right, and like, I thought
How are you sitting right now? You know, and yeah, how is your jaw? How are your eyebrows? You know, how are your hands?
Like, can you be relaxed?
Right.
Can you just relax?
Yeah. And so a big part of that is, man, whatever like is going on mentally, emotionally, is having a direct effect with how you're sitting, with your actual like posture, and that over time can lead to chronic problems. And so by correcting those and correcting our thoughts, like how that kind of goes hand in hand, then that can kind of help some things over time. When it comes to thoughts, there's a lot of research in MBSR that shows these actual changes in the brain. So we do see the amygdala shrink, and we see the hippocampus grow, and we see the prefrontal cortex connectivity increase. And so that's actually been shown through research with MBSR. So it's not just that people are saying, hey, this works, like this feels great, you know,
right.
It's
you
like
can,
we're
like,
actually
you can
seeing
look at people's mm-hmm. brains, what are the MRIs or whatever,
yeah.
and you're seeing differences.
Yep. And okay. And so I guess like a big thing with this is, you know, have you heard when someone says like, oh, that person has a greater pain tolerance than that
right.
person. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So pain is very much perceptual.
Mm-hmm.
It's not only just like this physical thing we feel.
Well, like when you go to the doctor's office, for instance, I went mm-hmm. to the doctor's office with my daughter, and she had sprained her ankle. We knew for sure it was at least sprained. We weren't sure if it was broken. And, you know, she said, you know, the lady said, you know, what's your pain level? And she said a 10. And
mm-hmm.
I was like, and for her, that's a 10 because it's the worst sprain that she's had,
mm-hmm.
you know? But I apologize to her for saying this afterwards, but I said, yeah, you know, like if you've had a kid given birth 4 times, your pain levels change, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I've had 3 C-sections.
Yeah.
And so it really is about your perception.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, I might be like, oh, it's a 10 if my leg was broken. But a sprain, I'd be like, eh, it's probably a 6 or a 7. You know what I mean? Like, who knows?
Right. Well,
I agree with what you're saying. It really is up to what have you experienced.
Well,
in
my case, this, you know, arthritic growth in my back and the injury to it, I dealt with it, you know, just experienced and just kept moving on.
Mm-hmm.
For a long time, and when I finally got to the point where, you know, I'm on a pretty strong medication to deal with the pain, the doctor looks at my x-rays and MRI and says, I'm surprised you can walk.
Mm.
You know, and I'm saying, well, my pain's at about a 4 or 5,
mm-hmm.
you know, with the medication. Well, it's about at a 6 or a 7 with the medication, it's at about a 3 or 4.
Uh-huh.
So I'm able to function. And I mean, you know, I take enough of the medication so that I'm able to function. Because
mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you know, I would, you know, spend a lot of time in bed
mm-hmm.
prone or, you know, wishing I was in the pool with, you know, no weight on my spine at all.
Yeah.
Getting rid of gravity. So yeah, the your perception of pain is, I mean, it just depends on where you came from on
mm-hmm.
And
right.
I know men are horrible about it. Oh, I'll be fine,
uh-huh.
rub some dirt in it, you know. I just, you know, I severed a finger here, get some duct tape.
Yeah. Yeah. It's merely a flesh wound.
Yeah, just a flesh wound.
Yeah.
I love Monty Python.
Yeah. Yeah, so and that's where it's like you have you're seeing your doctor and you are getting your doctor prescribed kind of treatment for
mm-hmm.
these real issues. And so just the suggestion is don't, you know, cut off your doctor and just do MBSR alone. But I'd give it a try and see what changes. You know, it doesn't, even that perception of pain can be really helpful. Because, so another big thing that MBSR is so important about, for, and you know, why I'm very passionate about it, is it could help a lot with preventing opioid addiction.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you go to the doctors and you have this pain, and what is the treatment, you know? And we don't want this medication to be the treatment modality, so.
It totally makes me think, sorry for interrupting again.
No.
Is that I'm thinking of, you know, my kids, and I'm thinking, okay, what am I teaching them to be able to get through things?
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's pain or conflict, hard conversations,
Disappointment.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a tough one for my youngest. She's 9. Disappointment is rough on her, mm-hmm. you know. And so what are the tools that I'm giving them? What am I modeling? What am I showing them? And so mm-hmm. I really enjoy this conversation because it can, you know, gathering these things up, whether we think that they're helpful for ourselves or not, just checking them out and seeing where does mm-hmm. this apply in my life? Can I teach this to someone? You know, learning about them so that, for instance, for myself, sorry to be about me, but I don't want my children, I don't want this pattern that's been going on in my family to continue to keep going,
mm-hmm.
you know, like equipping my girls with these skills to be able to figure out how to get through things so that hopefully it will get better for them. Just as my mom did things differently for me and things got better for me
mm-hmm.
than they were for her. You know, it's like that improvement. Like, can we improve
yes.
our society? Can
mm-hmm.
we improve our families
mm-hmm.
and work with each other and get information out there to better our situations?
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, absolutely.
So please continue. I'm sorry.
Just with what you were saying, that's huge. Like, you know, pain, and this is a big thing, that pain isn't just physical, right? It's emotional. You know, it's all these things. And can we learn how to deal with pain? And that's a big aspect to MBSR is to just confront those emotions. You know, we don't have a problem with, like, really dwelling on joyful emotions, right? You know, positive emotions. But, like, when it comes to negative emotions, like you were talking about, just disappointment and just, you know, feeling rejected and lonely and whatever it is, and just the sadness, depression, we will often, and this is where we go get into like addiction, you know, really, what, I mean, anyone listening right now, what is your addiction? It doesn't have to be drugs, right? Like, when you feel that way, you're anxious, scared, depressed, whatever, like, do you go to a bottle? Do you go to a pill? Do you go to something you can smoke? Do you
shopping?
Do you eat? Yep, go online, social media, you know what?
Do you
clean
the house?
Right.
You know,
like, it's like,
exercise?
Do you have to
obsessive or compulsive about anything?
Right.
Do you have to avoid that emotion? Are you unable to sit in that emotion
yeah.
and look at it?
Mm-hmm. Right.
I mean, really, that's what it boils down to, because if mm-hmm. I don't take on some of those, like, sit in the moment and be like, okay, why is it that I'm feeling this?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what's actually going on?
Mm-hmm.
I can sit in it for a few minutes and think on it, or I can do something that's going to take me out of it,
mm-hmm.
which could literally just be go have some food or
mm-hmm.
go shopping.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, like, I can avoid something for a really long time,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Right.
But then I'm not dealing with it. So what are the peaceful ways that are going to be positive to deal with something
yeah.
that might be hard to look at?
Yeah. Yeah. And so I really just invite all of us, like, in this time, like, just to think about, like, what are the tools that I use that, you know, that keep me from really just confronting this and seeing it, you know, because really we just, without confronting it, then it continues to be this huge monster, right? But then in reality, it's this mouse, you know, with a flashlight shining on it that makes
mm-hmm.
it look bigger than mm-hmm. it is.
That's awesome.
You know, yeah. And so, you know, are we able to sit in silence? Like, do we like ourselves? Can we be alone with ourselves and just be in that silence? MBSR really works on that. It doesn't, I know, like, some yoga practices, you detach. Like, that's not mindfulness at all, mindfulness-based stress reduction. You actually confront. Like, you just kind of, and maybe confront's not the best word, but you, like, enter into whatever is occurring. You kind of look it in the eyes.
Cool.
Yeah, and then from that, people have found a reduction of that, like, the negative emotions. Like, oh, I guess it's not that bad. Because the biggest thing is, you know, like, as human beings, the more we do that, we realize, like, emotions ebb and flow. So they're not going to be there the whole time. What a great thing that with time, like, we can remain strong and watch our emotions ebb and flow versus having our emotions making us move back and forth, up and down. You know, like, who's in control? Our emotions or, like, ourself?
I want to be a peaceful person, but I'm letting my anger lead me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that is,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
Yeah.
Like, making the choice to find ways to switch from, I'm going to be led by my anger and be explosive,
mm-hmm.
or I'm going to be peaceful and relax and breathe
yeah.
and just you know, and I like all the things that you talked about with like, you know, relaxing your body and, you know, thinking about all those things. Are you always tensed up? Are you, you know, like, are you afraid? Is the world seem unsafe? Because if it does, then, yeah.
Figuring out why you believe that. You know, we can take something that's small and by not dealing with it, grow it, you know, into a monster. Because it never, like you said, it never gets resolved. And just being able to recognize those things through like a mindfulness, a meditative state, which is, you know, something I do every day. You know, when I first get up in the morning, I do a little reading in my textbook. And I do, sometimes just a few minutes, just kind of quieting my mind and just seeing what's out there, what's, you know, if there's something bugging me or something that I want to accomplish, and just kind of focus in on that and hang with it for a minute or two, and, you know, make a decision on whether I want to work with that or on that you know, for a particular day. But I do have to be careful, because when I start acting on something in a panic, I've really got to check and see my motivation behind it. You know, do I really get it? Because I'm one of these guys who will, I will go in to wash the dishes and end up washing the window in front of the sink, and then all the rest of the windows in the house need to be washed.
But he never did.
I end up down this bunny trail, and the dishwasher's half full of dishes.
I'm not the only one. That's so great.
So yeah, being focused on things like that is important for me.
I really like this discussion today. I'm so glad you're here. This is so great.
Oh, I'm glad you guys have me. Really, it's just, it is, that's why I'm saying, like, this is such an exciting time to be a therapist. There's, like, we don't have to depend on a lot of the treatment that we've kind of come to learn to depend on. And
what did you think of your mother?
Fill in the blank.
Oh, boy.
I don't know. Maybe she does ask those questions. Yeah. I don't know.
You'll have to come and see me.
Yeah. I was thinking earlier as we were talking about how, you know, you were saying it takes time to get to know people and things. Oh. And I'm guessing, or would you say that, you know, as people start to trust you and as they're ready, they start to share different kinds of things? Because I think sometimes there's things that we don't even realize are there.
Yes.
And so we start feeling that we're safe to talk to someone. I think that, like, having that environment where you feel safe talking to one person or a small group or something is so crucial.
Yeah.
Because it's like once you say it out loud, I think that there's something so freeing in the fact that it was said out loud and it's not still in your head and your brain isn't like, where are you saying all these negative things about it? You got it out there. And I think that's the first step usually for me is to say it out loud to at least one person.
Yeah, and once you say something out loud that maybe has been haunting you, like it's no longer a secret.
Especially this shame kind of stuff.
Right.
Or whatever.
And it loses its power.
Yeah, it does lose its power.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, again, Casey, thank you so much. Boy, maybe down the road we can get back together with you and talk some more about this, because it's... It's new, it's exciting, and I personally have benefited greatly from this conversation.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, we can't help it. We love our listening audience, but we do get excited about when we get to learn new things that will help ourselves, because that's the journey we are on. Wouldn't
that's
you say?
Right.
That's a journey
Absolutely.
I'm on, and I see that with you, Johnny. Is,
that's right.
You know,
the farther I go down this road, the less I know. It's an amazing.
The more knowledge you get to.
Get to absorb. Yeah. And hopefully be helpful to others.
Exactly.